yet. I filed a trouble ticket, but I've heard no other response. Course email, you should have received an email from me an hour or so ago. If you, next time you check your email, you don't find you've received something from CS180, send me a note, because important announcements will come out as email. There may be announcements made via email that you won't see anyplace else. So you want to check on it once in a while. Send me a note from your @purdue.edu email address. If you're, you know, all your email is, you only use your Gmail account and you don't have your purdue.edu email forwarded to it, you won't see things because they go to your @purdue.edu email address. Website's not yet up to date, just as a warning. We'll get on that. And as I said, the real labs start next week. But you want to be there this week because that's going to make sure that you're ready to start on next week. Okay. We're going to start out today is with a review of some things that are general, and then I will point out kind of what's Java-specific about this. So, first thing, concept of primitive data types. So within a program, so within a program, you'll have variables. So, you know, something like this. This is a variable. A variable contains, it holds some sort of a value. Within Java, it can hold either a primitive data type or an instance of a class. We'll get into what instances of classes later. Let's start with the primitive data type. Primitive data type is something like a number or a letter, something very simple. In Java, it's what's referred to as a strongly typed language. That means that given a variable, it can only hold something of a particular data type. So, you know, if I said that this is a number, I can't put a character in it. I can only put numbers in. In particular, we identify things, so we'll say, for example, something is of type integer. Int. Bar 1. Int A. These are declarations. All this does is this tells us there is a variable 1 we're using in the program. There is a variable named A we're using in the program. Both of them will hold integers. And then an expression like this is saying you take the value that's in A, add 3 to it, and that's what goes into R1. The data types in Java, byte, short, int, long, all of these, for practical intents, they're integers. The difference between them is how big they can be. And the terms are kind of based on number of bits. So a byte, 8 bits, that gives an integer which is between, you know, -128 and 127. Short, 16 bits, int is 32 bits, long is 64 bits. Basically, for, you know, for now, just use Int unless you have a reason to use otherwise. Some of you will think, oh, well, wouldn't it be more efficient just to use a byte? Well, in some ways, yes. But in practical terms, on most processors today, it really isn't. Any ideas why that is? Why your program will probably be faster if you use Int rather than byte? Yeah.
Well, most processors are multi-threaded, and most computing have more than one core now.
Yeah. Well, it's not actually based on the number of cores and the multi-threading, but it is based on the processor architecture.
And your word size is usually not the size of the Int.
Internally in the processor, it has registers that hold a certain sized item. When I was your age, it was 8 bits. Nowadays, those are typically 32 bits, or in some processors, they're 64 bits. Which means if you've got something that's a byte, it's going to have to take it and say, oh, well, let's extend this out to 32 bits to use it in the processor. And then we'll shrink it back to 8 bits later, which actually slows you down some. Int, 32 bits, very rare that you're actually going to get a number that's too big for you. So most of the time, you'll just be able to use Int. Float and double are different. Float is, these are floating point numbers. The simple way to think of a floating point number is like scientific notation. 3.57 times 10 to the minus 2. Hopefully you all know what that is. This is actually how things are represented, except it's done in binary. This gets a little bit confusing. You know, you get 1.0110 times 2 minus 4. And at this point, that's probably going to be pretty hard to get your head around. When you take the computer architecture course, you'll get into that. For now, you can just think of it as it's something like this, and you don't even have to worry about this part. You can just treat it as a decimal number. And again, float and double, the difference is this is packing it all into 32 bits, this is into 64 bits. This will give you, a more precise answer, because sometimes some of the less significant digits might get lost in the 32 bits. But most of the time, you won't need to worry about that. The other data types that are the primitive data types we get are Boolean and char, and Boolean char string are things that are built into the Java language. Boolean, as it sounds, it's either one or zero. Well, actually, true or false. So Boolean value is true or false. A character is a single character of a constant. Like this. So I can do something like that. String, several characters. I don't have the iClickers set up yet. I wasn't going to make you buy CPS pads. So let me just hear. Here from you.
String.
Several of you. There's something up there that would tell you string is not a primitive data type. What do you see that's different about string than the others?
Capital
S. Capital S. That means it's a class. That is a convention. There's nothing in the Java language that says classes have to start with capital letters, primitive data types have to start with lowercase letters. It's a convention that everybody follows. To the point that if you create a class that doesn't start with a capital letter, An experienced Java programmer will look at your program and think it's wrong. It'll just seem so wrong to do it that way. It's such a standard convention. What that means is these others, you kind of have built-in operations. String is a class, so there are methods that you use on it. We'll see as we go on into the class what the difference is there. So the answer, yes, is string. So once we have these variables, we have some values placed into them, what can we do with them? Well, here we have operators. The simplest assignment, it takes whatever the value is that results from this, and it puts it into the variable that's over here. Now, do you think I could do something like this? I mean, you might think you ought to be able to do something like that. I mean, that's really just saying A equals R minus 3, right? Well, algebraically, yes. But from a Java language point of view, it isn't that smart. It doesn't figure that out for you. The left side of an assignment is a variable. Hold some value. The right side can be an expression where you figure some things out. Other operators, you have binary operators. That means they have a left side and a right side. And they put the two together in some way and give you a result. When you look at these up to here, they're pretty straightforward and obvious mathematical operations. They actually will often be used in some kind of funny ways. So I can take two strings and add them. Let's see. Now that doesn't make sense. Add Chris and Clifton.
Can you subtract them?
Yeah. It's concatenation. Mm-hmm. So adding two strings is concatenation. Subtracting two strings? Multiplying, you definitely can't do that. And division, that gets confusing. This is actually the modulus operator. Think of it as remainder. In doing division, that would be the integer remainder. Unary operators, you stick this in front of something and it changes it. That will basically do nothing to something, to an integer. Now this minus, plus plus, minus minus, those are kind of funny. Those come out of C programmers who are notorious for writing things that, in as obscure a way as possible. What that does, so if I take a variable A and put two pluses after it, what that's going to do is it's going to increment the value that's in A. But it's going to do something else. It's going to return a value. It's going to return that value. That also returns the value. But, and increments A. The difference is, this increments and then returns, let's see, this returns a value, and it's backwards. This increment or returns a value and increments. No, I think this one returns the value, then it adds one to it. This one adds one to it, then returns the value. It's kind of funny, because basically what happens, all of these operators return a value. They give you a value back. And so you think of this as just incrementing the value. Well, it's actually also giving something back. And, as is this. Exclamation point. not operator, so for a Boolean, turns true into false. Relational operators, equal. This is one you really want to remember. This compares two things and returns true or false, as opposed to a single equal, which is an assignment. Now in Java, it's not going to be that bad. When you go on and use some other languages, C, for example, equal returns a value. It sets, just like here, we say var1 gets the value of 3 plus A, and then in C, it would return the value that you created from this. So I could say, A plus var1 equal 3 plus A in C. Very confusing. Why would you do that? What does it mean? Well, what it typically means is you really meant to use a double equal when you just use one. Java, you won't have that problem because you use assignments where you're not returning a value. You use relational where you're returning a value. And so it'll tell you, whoops, you need another sign in there. Not equal, greater. These are all obvious with not integers, but you can also use them with characters, with strings. We'll even see later on how you can create your own types and use these operations with them. I said that these things return a value. What is the type of the value they return? It's a Boolean. They return true or false. So, I couldn't say, A equal X greater than Y, but I could say because this is an integer, this is a Boolean, but I could do this. Whether you ever actually have a reason to do that, I have my doubts. But it's legal. Conditional operators, those are again Boolean. They take two Booleans and return a Boolean, and or. So A and B, but both are true, the result is true. A or B, if either one is true, the result is true. And there's others. Go into the documentation about the Java language. You'll be able to find all of them. There's some that are so obscure you'd never imagine why you might use them. I'm not going to worry too much about that. That's the correct answer. I threw that in because in C, that is actually a legal operator. In Java, it isn't. But each of these have some meaning in Java. They're an operator. This is a Boolean. Forget what that does. That is actually a bitwise AND. We'll get into that sort of thing later. But okay, so expressions. An expression generates a value. So these are some examples of expressions. A plus 3 generates a value. C equal 4, it also would return a value in C. In Java, you'd never really use it that way. I think it's legal, but you want to avoid that. Whereas a statement is this kind of single self-contained action that you ask a program to do. Now this is kind of a weird one because here we're doing two things. We're both declaring the variable A. We're saying A is an integer, and I'm going to make it equal to 3. All at once. you'll see that a lot. Personally, I grew up with Pascal where you had to separate that, so you'd have your declaration, and then you'd have your use, and you wouldn't actually do that at one time. It's a matter of style. Here's a statement that is a call to a method. It's a function call. You know, in JavaScript, it's a method. It's calling this println method. A little more is, what it's saying is, I take the variable system, and system is actually a variable of a class type. And what's contained in that, or that variable has a attribute within it called out. That's what this dot means. And that dot has a method, you know, that out thing has a method println that can run on it. And I call that method hello world. So this is getting into kind of use of classes. And it's a class that contains the class, contains a method. So there's some examples of statements, expressions. You know, if you've done any programming, you've done things like this before. It's just slightly different syntax. One thing you'll notice, each of these statements is terminated with a semicolon. In Java, all statements are terminated with a semicolon. This is a little bit different from C, where you'll see semicolons there, but in C, a semicolon separates two statements. The difference is, in the last statement in a program, C, you don't need a semicolon after it. Java, you do. But when you compile it, it'll complain, it'll tell you that, so you'll find out. Conditionals, if then else, syntax, you type if, and then you have an expression, value it's to true or false. If it's true, then you do what's in statement, which is enclosed in these braces. Otherwise, a brace, a statement, another brace. There's also a statement, there's also a conditional called switch. Switch takes an expression, and then you have, you know, in the case that expression returns 1, it returns 2, you do this. In a default, you do this statement. You'll see those as we go along. A lot of these, the details of how these work, you can read them in the book, or you'll be able to pick them up just by looking at the programs. You'll see a program, you'll say, I know what that should do, and I see this switch expression, I know it's a condition. You'll be able to look at the code and figure that out. We're not going to go through all the details of every expression. Some of this you are going to need to pick up on your own. That's not because we're trying to make it hard on you or because we're trying to skip through. It's because we want to get you into the habit of thinking, how do I learn about a new language? Because as you go on through your career, if you don't learn new languages, you'll end up like these COBOL programmers who knew nothing else and all of a sudden realize they're out of the job because nobody's writing COBOL anymore. You need to be able to pick up new things. You need to be able to learn new things. And so this, you know, will give you practice doing that. You'll start seeing these things in programs and pick up on how they work. Looping expressions, we have three. We have while, an expression. While this is true, execute statement. And then we have the do while, do this statement while the expression is true. What's the difference between this? I'm saying, you know, while the expression is true, continue executing statement. Here I am saying, execute this statement while the expression is true. It's when you check. And what's the kind of end result of the difference between this? Yeah.
Do while always executes at least once.
Yeah. This statement is going to always happened once. Then you check, and if this isn't, if this is true, then it does it again. The first one, if it's false at the beginning, it'll never happen. So do you want this to happen zero more times, or do you want to have it happen one or more times? And then the for statement, again, it's repeating things, but it's a little funny because you can convert any for statement into a while statement. But you use it in a for when you think, okay, I've got some things I do at the beginning. I have something that I want to be the ending condition, and I have something that changes each time that will get me to that termination condition. And then what you do in here shouldn't really affect this, whether you reach the termination. It should be based on this happening. Now, there's nothing in the language that's going to prevent you from that. I could say, you know, for I equals 0, I less than 10, I plus plus, to be very common. And then in here, I could say, you know, I equals I times 2. Perfectly legal. It would work. But it's very bad style. If you've got something like that where you're changing what affects the termination condition inside the loop, you really should be using a while statement. Otherwise, people are going to have a hard time understanding. They'll read it, when you read a for loop, you read it thinking, oh, I can just look at here and figure out how many times it's going to happen. When I look in here, I just figure out what it's doing each time. Many of these, as we start looking at programs, you'll see more of them, and this will make more sense. Okay. Methods. Other languages, you'll see them called functions. This is a key thing to understand. What you're doing is you're taking a statement or set of statements and grouping them together and basically creating a new expression, a new operator in a sense. Consists of a few parts. So you have first this word public. We'll get into what that means later. It's useful to break a very large program into separate parts and have the parts not conflict with each other. For now, you'll be safest if you just make everything public. Otherwise, you'll get some strange errors that just won't make sense to you. Later on, we'll see more about that. Int. That means it returns the primitive type integer. You could also have it return a class, or you could have it return void, which means it returns nothing. Void is kind of a primitive data type. Well, it's really it's a primitive non-data type. This is returning an integer. And then we have the name of the method, and then we have the arguments. And each argument has a particular type. So we have integer A, integer B. What does it do? It adds A and plus B and returns that. Okay. Some other things that come into this, you know, what's all is in this? We have these modifiers. Public is the one you should worry about for now. Static, you'll see once in a while. In particular, every program you write will have a main function. That's where it starts. And you know, so one class at least in your program will have a main function. That's the beginning. And that one will be static. That will have to be static. Other uses of static we'll come into later. What all the rest of these mean, we'll get to later. Some of them we probably won't even get to. Return types, well, that should be fairly straightforward. Method is an expression. You know, when you call it, you get a result back. But parameters. And then there is an exception list. It may say, after the parentheses, the parent, it may say throws and then a class. We'll get into what that means later. For now, you won't see those, or if you do see them in other code, just ignore it. And then you have the body. So the black are things that should make some sense to you at this point. If they don't, get more into this. And once you start writing a few programs and seeing a few programs, it should come to you. Some of the others are things we'll get into later. Okay, so that's some basic ideas, a very basic review of some of the concepts of the language. And these are concepts that are common across most computer languages. Probably the key difference in Java with respect to those concepts is this being a strongly typed language, that values have those primitive types or a class. A variable can be declared a particular class type, and that's all it can hold, is that class. You can't, if I declare something as a string, I can't put a character in it. Only strings. Okay, so that's some ideas that about the language. Now, but programming isn't just about understanding the language. It's about solving problems. What we're after is having a set of activities that allow us to, we can execute in order to solve a given problem. And here's an interesting definition. The idea, what's involved in solving a problem? Well, first you understand it. You devise a plan, you execute the plan, and you review the solution. This really is what I would consider the programming part of this. You're coming up with a plan, executing that plan, running the program, and then seeing whether the results are correct and how to use those, reviewing the solution. But it's not just about the programming. A big part of it is understanding the problem so that you can devise it. Another thing that's kind of new in this course, object-oriented programming. What's that about? Well, here you'll see object-oriented programming refers to a set of activities that lead to a computer program written in an object-oriented language. That's kind of a circular definition. An object-oriented program is one written in an object-oriented language. An object-oriented language is one used to write object-oriented programs. That doesn't help us. What it really talks about is that this notion of an object that kind of encapsulates data, encapsulates the functions on that, and you think of that abstractly. That's really what object-oriented programming is about. Everything you will see in Java, any program, it's a class. And a class, it describes a type of object. And you put programs together by combining classes. So it really works out as a different way of thinking about your programs. So you will see me draw up these boxes on the board. I'll kind of draw up a rectangle. That's an object. And I'll say it has certain attributes in it. And certain methods that it can operate on. That's what you're doing with the object. This may be different from the type of programming you've done in the past, where you think about what are the functions I execute? What are the steps I take? And so we'll, as we go on, we'll move to from thinking about the steps you take to thinking about the data you're using. And then the steps are kind of secondary. So you know, here's an example class. Class bool. Actually, a bool wasn't, it was boolean. I think I had that slide wrong. It was boolean, not bool. You know, class bool has a boolean value. It has a, you know, an is true method that returns the value. It has a what's called a constructor. When I first create a bool, I have to call this constructor. And that takes a parameter that's this initial value. I set value equal to initial. And at the end of it, I've got a type, bool. I can declare a variable of type bool. And I can do things. Simple class you can create. And now you start thinking of the methods you execute on that class. So you'll notice this is true. I'm not giving it any arguments. How does it know whether it should return true or false? Well, that comes out of what's encapsulated in B. It actually comes out of the data. So I think of this as I'm not just calling a function, but I'm actually asking B something about itself, to do something with itself. This concept is really the core of object-oriented programming. For those of you who haven't kind of thought of a program that way or thought of an algorithm that way, that's going to be the hardest thing to get your head around. Once that makes sense, you'll have a whole new way of developing programs. And you'll find this very useful. Okay, so problem solving using object-oriented programming. Well, we understand the problem, but often, you know, we're designing this solution using objects. So when we understand the problem, we'll often think not just what are the steps I need to do to solve the problem, but you'll think, what are the objects that are interacting in order to solve this problem? Different way of thinking about it. Design a solution, implement it as a well-documented program, test, debug, correct that program. Compiling and executing, the edit, compile, execute cycle, you'll start by editing a Java program. You save that as your .java files. Each class goes in its own file. You don't put everything together in one file. You compile it. What that's doing is the computer is taking the Java program you've written and it's doing two things. One, it is checking to make sure that it looks like a legal program. Not quite the same thing as saying a correct program. The computer doesn't know what your program is supposed to do. It just knows what the Java program you've written says it's going to do. So it's going to tell you, is this a legal Java program? Not is it the right Java program? once you've compiled, well, either there'll be an error, it's going to say, hey, this isn't a legal Java program, and comes back and you have to edit it. Or it's going to say, yes, this is a legal Java program, at which point you can run it. And I'm going to go ahead and take just a little bit of time to pull this up and just show you, assuming this all still works. Ah! Okay. I've got to, oh, I don't know what's... Yeah, they've switched over to Windows 7, and I don't know whether in the process they have... wiped out my ability. Okay, I'm going to have to figure out what they've got wrong here, what they've broken in. Okay, and this is great. Oh, now it's launched. I see. It just took that long to launch. And in the meantime, it's probably not going to let me... Okay. Well, we'll worry about that. We'll be doing some examples in the future when we'll be using Dr. Java. It's an integrated development environment. What that means is it allows you to do the editing, the compiling, the executing the program all together. It's all built in, combined. So you don't have to use separate programs to do each of these. Eclipse is another example of a Java integrated development environment. We're not certain if we're going to be using the Ridgesoft robot or the Lego robot at this point. We need to check and see which ones seem to be the least broken. But that may involve using a different development environment. In lab today, or this week, you'll see Dr. Java. You'll get the chance to play with that a little bit. It just makes life a little bit easier than hand editing things. Like when you compile, if there's an error, it highlights where that error is, so that you don't have to go searching. Okay, so that's, and for some of you who may have done programming in environments where you don't have this sort of a cycle. You have what are referred to as interpreted languages where you just, it runs what you've written directly. You don't have this extra step of compiling. Don't worry about that. Compiling is just doing two things. It's checking for an illegal program, something that isn't correct Java, and it's producing something that's more easily read by the machine. That will come out as you'll see these .class files. Those are more easily read by the machine than the .java files. Okay, some other things we'll be getting into in this class. Multi-core processors. What's a multi-core processor? Well, it contains two or more cores. Each core is capable of executing its own sequence of instructions. So I have some things, I have a program running over here, and I have another program running over here. For most of my professional lifetime, Moore's Law held, which basically said that every 18 months or so, the processor speed would double. That has ceased. Now, the way they're getting faster speeds is they're not making the processor run faster, but they're putting more cores on a processor. They're saying, okay, we're going to sell you a processor 18 months from now that's twice as fast. Well, not really. It runs the same speed, it just can do four things at one time instead of only two things at one time. Now, why is this interesting? Well, this means if we're going to keep improving and keep speeding up, you need to be able to use all of these processors. This gets into a parallel computer. Parallel computers have been around for a long time, but up until the last few years, they were specialized, only used by people who really needed the highest performance, and you had kind of specially trained programmers working with them. And now, well, probably most of the laptops out there are parallel computers. Mm-hmm. A few of us still have some old machines lying around, but most of, you know, a multi-core microprocessor is a parallel computer. Or something that contains multiple single-core processors. So pretty much everything today is multi-core. Why does this get interesting? Well, because most of the programs we write are sequential. Every step happens in order. Mm-hmm. Well, if I've got a bunch of steps going on in order, how do I send off and use that other core, that other processor, to do anything? I could say, okay, the next one gets executed over here. Well, this one's going to have to wait until it's done. That's not going to happen. So we're getting faster processors by adding cores, but if we write a sequential program, it's not going to run any faster. So one of the concepts we're going to work on in this course, and as you start to think of things in an object-oriented fashion, it gets easier, is concurrent programs. They contain instructions that you can execute in parallel. Different parts can be executed at the same time. In particular, in Java, you have what are called threads. What you'll do is you'll say, okay, at some point I'm going to start off multiple threads. Basically, I'm going to, it's like you could think of it as you call a method, but you say, okay, I'm not going to wait for it to finish. It's going to run, and I'm going to go on and call another method. And they're going to both run at the same time. This is becoming more and more important to be able to do this. And so we'll start thinking that way. So, you know, here's a simple example that we're going to have to hold until next Wednesday. Because I realize we're at time. So next week we will get into an example of a concurrent program that I'll do that. Anyway. There will be recitations on Friday, where we go into more details on the language. And lab this week, because the environment. There will be lab next week. Notice that the next lab, so Tuesday, that will be before.
I'll probably blow it off, though.